Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 25th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education, or Kaplan Financial Education, make that correctly, and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to be looking at a number of different issues that have arisen in taxes. Now, you may remember last week we got stuck on a special session with the new application for forgiveness. So we have a few things happening this week that are new. So we're going to take a look at a few additional PPP issues. In reality, we're kind of going back to the previous week, because as I mentioned last week, we had things all ready to go, and then we got all this brand new guidance. Well, this week again, same similar thing happens. We have guidance ready to go. I'm going to do the prior week, so I'm going to do the missing week, and I've got a couple of new things from this week. And then on Friday night, we got a couple of big new things coming in. So I've decided, though, I can't really push back the developments much further. So we'll take a look and see what we can do about the other parts of this, and maybe if I have time, get another program together that'll relate to that particular area of what they clarified on Friday night, because I suspect we may see more guidance here. There's been rumors we'll have more guidance before the weekend's over. So we'll be looking at a few things happening. But one of the key things that happened this week was that we did have in our mix additional guidance here. And what we had here was we got new guidance on temporary changes for the Paycheck Protection Program loan that dealt with forgiveness. And this was a little bit strange. This stuff came out very late in the evening, around 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on May 22nd. It is the IFR on forgiveness. And what this really does is gives us some information about the formal guidance on forgiveness. We'll talk a little bit more about it if I get to do that full taping I'd like to do here shortly, so we can talk a little bit more about what they did. But they came up with some clarifications. It's pretty clear now that owner employees really does mean people who have an ownership interest in stock. So if you were thinking that, well, it wasn't really stockholders or stockholders didn't really count, well, that's probably not true. It probably will now count for like S Corp and C Corp stockholders. So it'll be in that mode. We had some other clarifications about the limitations that are involved, how apparently those stockholders are going to be impacted by the rules that limit your classification for things like medical and retirement plan contributions. We have some restrictions apparently there. We'll also have some additional clarifications, make it pretty clear you really do get more than 8 weeks in the 8 week period, based on the incurred and paid, and a couple of other clarifications are there. At the same time, they released a brand new set of temporary changes for the Paycheck Protection Program. They talked about loan forgiveness. And what ends up happening there is, and actually that's a duplicate. What really ends up happening is on that day, we got some more clarification about exactly what's going to happen. We talk about doing this whole loan forgiveness, how they're going to review loans, what the SBA will review if they do review a loan, and how exactly that's going to work. So that was additional clarification that we got when all of this came through. So we'll talk about that more in detail because that could take a whole bunch of time. Let's talk specifically about the stuff we missed from last week, from 2 weeks ago, and the stuff we have this week. So I want to start out with another one of these interim final regulations. We've had a ton of these, as you're probably aware. We've had a bunch of these come down. And this one dealt with the treatment of foreign affiliates. And the question became, some people had decided that maybe the way it was written, the 500 employee rule didn't really cause you a problem if you had foreign affiliates that kicked you over 500. If they were U.S. affiliates, they would have kicked you over the limit. But because they were foreign and this didn't cover foreign employees, that you could ignore that. Well, eventually what happens is we have here the SBA decides, no, that's not really how this was meant to go. The SBA says the foreign affiliate rule does count for the 500 employee limit. And you're going to use the standard SBA affiliation rules. Now, they did put in a special exceptions for loans made before the SBA clarified on May 5th. On May 5th, the SBA put information into their FAQs that they claim made it clear you had to count foreign affiliates. If a loan had been fully disbursed before May 5th and it covered, you know, and basically you're not qualified now because you had a foreign affiliate and you shouldn't have gotten the loan under these rules, you're fine. Now, if there's any part of that that had not yet been disbursed, you can't take more out. And secondly, you can only use it to support U.S. payrolls, U.S. options. So you can't use it to pay foreign expenses. They have some rules there. So there are some restrictions, but if you ran into that problem, you had a foreign affiliate, you took the position and your bank took the position that they didn't count for the 500 employee limit, you're okay, kind of. You just can't get anything new. That's probably the big takeaway. Now, we also had here a clarification that actually got a lot of kind of snickering feedback, shall we say, at the time, because this was issued just before they issued the application for forgiveness. But what they decided was that, in fact, certain utilities exempt from tax under 501c12 would be allowed to apply for a paycheck protection loan. And their logic was kind of interesting here, because generally, tax exempts except 501c3s are not allowed to get a paycheck protection loan. The program did not allow for any entity that was a tax exempt that was not a C3 to get it. We've seen a couple of ways they've written around that rule. We talked a little bit previously about tax-exempt hospitals that could find ways around, even though they hadn't applied for C3 exemption because they were owned by a city or state and didn't need it. Well, we've got a similar issue going here. We're going to be working on this issue. So they decided, look, C3s generally are what can get this. But, you know, C3s can get it, but so can for-profit entities. So what the SBA decides to do is they decide that these electrical co-ops are actually profit-seeking entities. While we don't charge taxes, they don't have to pay income taxes, they are a cost savings, a cost-sharing option among the various parties. So they say, so it really is kind of a for-profit enterprise. And so because of this, they rule, they actually qualify for PPP loans. So the good news is they can get their loan money, and these entities can apply for and be granted the loan by a bank. Well, you know, that was, so, you know, if you've got one of those, it's covered. A lot of people were complaining at the time because we were still missing the forgiveness. And this clearly was a ruling that applied to a relatively small subset of borrowers. And the theory being, we're getting the really important stuff out, huh? Well, I think we got the easy stuff out was actually what it was about. But nevertheless, they got it done. I'm sure there was some push from someone that wanted that together. So they finally got it done. Now, you may remember we've had a few cases where the safe harbor repayment date has been pushed back on two occasions originally. And this goes back to that whole issue that was involved when we had the whole Potbelly, Ruth Chris, and Shake Shack controversy about borrowing funds that they quote unquote didn't need. Initially, we were told that we would have a safe harbor for repayment. That safe harbor was going to be May 7th. If you repaid, then we wouldn't worry about whether or not you had to have the loan. Then that got pushed back to the 14th. Finally, they pushed it back to the 18th, and that's because they again had changed the rules. And so the rules are going to be slightly different. Now, what they've done is, as we said, this eliminated the good faith issues. It also got them to the employee retention credit if they wished. The key issue, though, at this point was we saw pushback, pushback, pushback. You might have wondered on May 18th, were they going to push back again? And at that point, they decided they're done. No additional extension of time was given. Now, as we'll discover, we had a major change that may very well mean a lot of people that were worried about that deadline should not have been worried. May have other problems with what they did, but we don't have that issue. So it's not as big as it was, but that date's definitely gone by. So if you do repay at this point, you may still have to justify why you needed the loan. And more importantly, you won't get the employee retention credit unless they change the law to allow for that. Now, I say that only because we have two bills currently being considered, one in the House, one in the Senate, to make changes to the PPP loan program. Both of them would extend the time frame for using the money. The House bill would go for 24 weeks. The Senate bill would go for 16 weeks. Don't be surprised if they compromise on 20 weeks. Each one has some other quirks. One of the key quirks, though, that we found was at least in one version of the House bill, though it does not appear to be in the current version, they would expand the employee retention credit to cover all employers instead of just those that had not taken forgiveness. As it stands right now, the last version of the House bill I saw had back in it, they said, nope, we're not going to do that. We're going to go back and let everybody defer payroll taxes, but we're not going to actually give the ERC. But keep an eye. I'm still not convinced the ERC may not be expanded. There is some taste for doing that among various people in Congress of both parties. The catch is, can we get enough in total to actually get that to happen? Not really clear. Now, the other problem you may have had is your clients may have run into problems where the bank gave them a PPP loan figure and our PPP loan draw. You know, they said, this is the amount you get. And we later discovered that per guidance the SBA gave us, that in fact, we would have qualified for a bigger loan. And the problem becomes is like, well, I've already got my loan. Can I get another draw? Well, for some people, that answer will be yes, but unfortunately, it's very limited. This was RIN 3245-AH42. This was, again, business loan, temporary changes, paycheck protection program, loan increases. This gives us a limited option for a second draw on PPP loans for partners in a partnership. The reason being, the SBA had initially kind of given the idea that partnerships should apply for a loan, but partners would not be dealt with right away. Later, they changed their mind and decided we'll treat partners as employees and apply with the main group. The problem was by then the partnership already had its loan for employees. It hadn't included partners, and had it tried to include them, the bank probably said, no, you can't do that. So they'll say, okay, that group we want to do something special for, and there's a second group we want to do something special for, and that would be seasonal businesses. If you recall, late in the game, the Small Business Administration told us that seasonal businesses could use testing periods that could be any 12-week period from May 1st of 2019 that would go all the way through September 15th of 2019, and it's a sliding period. You can find the period in there that would test best for you and qualify you for the largest loan. Of course, the problem is that came out so late that all these companies already had loans. So what they're going to do is they said, because that guidance came out late and because people got less, we will allow in a limited case a bank to violate the rule and essentially ask for an approval to send a second disbursement out to the borrower based on solely these two reasons why the loan amount was too small. Now, that's kind of a problem. Because the hitch is there are a lot of other cases where banks issued loans for amounts that were less than what was ultimately allowed. There was confusion until we got to the self-employed week about, let's say, a sole proprietorship that had employees. The applications allowed those companies to apply right at the first on April 3rd. However, major banks, Bank of America specifically I know of, would simply ignore the owner, said, we loan on the employees only. Well, they would have said we loaned on the employees only to a partnership. But remember, the example here, or who can get into this, does not include proprietorships. Only partners got this special break. So the problem is that they can't go back and get it fixed. A similar problem occurs in other cases where the banks early in the program changed their interpretation of programs and may have loaned people less than they otherwise could qualify for. There's a reverse problem. In many cases, the banks gave businesses more than they should have qualified for, and it's still not clear how that resolves itself at the back end. But certainly the less, you'd think I should be able to go in. If Bank of America didn't give me the part that represents, 2.5 months of my Schedule C earnings, I should be able to ask for that draw. Problem is, this guidance does not allow you to do this. There's another quirky issue with this guidance. The bank can only do this second draw if it has not yet submitted to the SBA Form 1502, which is actually, if you want to understand it in full, is really an Excel sheet if you go look at it. Once the bank submits that 1502 and starts reporting disbursements, it can no longer make the second distribution. Now, the SBA did push back the dates the bank had to give that to the SBA, probably to give themselves some time. But it's still kind of a problem that we've got. It's an issue. Now, here's the big one the week before that was a real problem. We mentioned it last week in the payroll protection program discussion for the application for forgiveness. But let's go into it in more detail now. This is an update to the frequently asked questions on May 13th of 2020. And this is going to provide for a good faith presumption of certification of the necessity of a loan as long as the balance in question is less than $2 million. If you remember, the SBA had already indicated that they were going to take a review of every loan in excess of $2 million, and at the same time, they told everybody that they would review loans below that. And when we got to question 37, they specifically said that, you know what, it doesn't matter the size of the loan. If you didn't need it, then you made a false certification to the SBA, and we are going to come and check up on you. So some small businesses would be reviewed. That caused more than a few small businesses, those who got far less than $2 million, to get worried. And maybe they needed it, but they didn't want to worry about potentially being second-guessed. You know, what if things, you know, I went out, I got the loan, I applied for the loan, but now things haven't gone as bad as I thought they might have, that it appeared they would at the beginning. Am I going to be second-guessed? So the company may very well have gone ahead and paid back the money. So now they're sitting there, they paid back the money, they weren't happy about it, but, you know, they figured that they didn't want to take the risk. And, you know, so let's just do it. I'm done. No problem. Now, out of the blue, on May the 13th, this was the day before one of the dates you were supposed to pay back the loan. So just barely after May 7th, which we thought was the first date you had to do it. And just barely before the 14th, which was the second day, they announced this relief. They very clearly said that as long as the loan was less than $2 million, we are going to presume that the certification of need for the loan was made in good faith. Meaning, if you paid the money back and you were below $2 million, tough luck. Because there is no provision in here that allows a borrower who paid back the loan because they were worried about what the SBA was going to do and they didn't want to face a potential review, nothing came out and said, you guys can go ahead and get your loan. You know, you can get your money back. That's not in there. There's a single draw. You've taken it. Yes, you can get the employee retention credit. Yeah, but, you know, if that's not really the thing you wanted, if that's not the preferable one for you, you're just kind of stuck at this point. Now, they also at this point, I think, backed off something in a big way. And that is they also indicate the consequences of the reviews for those with more than $2 million. And they really took the teeth out of those as well. What they said here is if you had a loan in excess of $2 million, that as long as you paid it back, we wouldn't worry about whether or not your certification was in error. Now, it's not clear when they say pay it back. Do they mean paid it back in the sense of have to do it right away or pay it over the 2 years? But in either event, if you get the money back in, we're not going to worry. You had access to credit markets. You didn't need the money. There's no problem. So the big threats that occurred the weekend, you know, right after the Ruth Chris situation, suddenly they're backing way off those, I think, because it eventually didn't play out the way they'd like. And because it scared people to pay it back that they now are worried about they scared the wrong people, they backed off this. The real problem is that there's no good relief for anybody who paid it back and now discovers that, well, you know, you really should never have believed us in the first place. We're just kidding. Bad news, but the way it worked. Let's go ahead and look at some regular tax developments now outside the PPP loan program. And the first key one is an IRS memorandum, AM 2020-004, issued on May the 22nd, that was looking at issues related to the valuation of stock-based compensation in three particular cases. They looked here at non-qualified stock options. They looked at a stock-settled stock appreciation rights program and a stock-settled restricted stock unit program. Now, as they kind of talked about in here, the second category here, stock-settled SAR, that's not really normal. Stock appreciation rights normally are not settled in stock. They're settled in cash, and this does not apply. This looks at the simple case which is meant to help us here, as to what happens if an employee, when they come up to the rights on this, in the case of a non-qualified option or a SAR, stock appreciation right, where they go ahead and they exercise the option or exercise the right. In the case of an RSU, those generally, when you hit the date that you no longer will forfeit the RSU, it converts to a real shares of stock. So the question becomes, how do we value those, and when are the payroll taxes due? Because the issue is, I decide as the employer, okay, you get stock, so we've got this stock ready. What usually happens is that, you know, we have this date, we do it, but then we transfer it over to the brokerage firm. And the brokerage firm will then get it into the employee's account. Now, it takes some time to do this. Usually it's the next day. But when you have a highly volatile market, there could be, as we've had recently, there could be a wild difference between the value on the date of exercise or vesting and the value on the date it actually gets in the account. And the question becomes, do we use the date it was exercised, or do we go ahead and wait till it's actually in the account and then value it when it gets in the account? Well, the IRS in this case has decided that in reality, it should be the date of exercise vesting. Their view on that is the date when the benefits and burdens have transferred. The employee made a decision that we are going to, you know, exercise these options. And when they make that decision, now whatever happens to the stock, up, down, whatever goes on, that's going to be their problem. That's not going to be an issue for the company anymore. The stock has been transferred, everything has gone over. So the idea is, if benefits and burdens have transferred, even if you don't have physical custody yet, you have beneficial ownership. They decided the beneficial ownership date counts. So that's going to impact both the valuation of the shares, which will impact what the employee pays in tax, but it also affects the payroll tax date. They tell us if you owe, you know, because the employer is going to owe payroll taxes on this exercise. And they tell us, if you are in the position where you owe payroll taxes, the pay date is considered to be the date of vesting or the date of exercise, depending upon which one of these three we're looking at. And in that case, you know, you have to count your if you go over $100,000, you got to do it by the next day. It is the day after the vesting or the day after the exercise, not the day after it shows up in the employee's account. So clarification indicates, you know, does some things for us. So, you know, something of use. Next development is going to be in Notice 2020-33. This came out on May 12th of 2020. And what they did there was they have decided that the amount of carryover allowed in a flexible spending account, a medical flexible spending account, I should say, inside of a cafeteria plan, that's been fixed at $500 for a while. You know, it's been in place for quite a few years and it's remained fixed. The actual amount you can defer has gone up every year. It's attached to inflation, but the deferral did not. So what they've now done is they're going to link that max deferral to 20%. They're going to link the carryover, which is what you can use and carry over throughout the next year. They're going to increase that to 20% of the maximum deferral. So the idea being, if your cafeteria plan, because there are two options, there is effectively, you know, a period that you can use it at the beginning of the year, or which you could use any balance remaining, or we can offer this carryover into the following year that you can use all throughout the following year. Now, initially, they simply offered the grace period through March 15th, which could be unlimited amounts, but you had to get it spent by March 15th. Later, we went to this carryover rule. And the carryover rule is probably what I've seen most cafeteria plans exercise now or use this day. So that's going to be now increased. So that will no longer just be $500. It'll initially go to $550, and then it will continue to be 20% of whatever the maximum deferral is. If the maximum deferral goes up due to inflation changes, this will go up. Okay? As we said, it did not affect the other standard rule, I should say, the other option of being able to use it the next year under the grace period. That does not change. They also put here a neat little provision. It will allow those individually coverage HRAs to reimburse premiums paid in a prior year for current year coverage. What that's about is, You know, normally we pay our medical insurance premiums a month ahead of time. Well, if you have a individual coverage HRA, you know, we're told those are okay, but the problem is I can't really get the January payment. If I'm being reimbursed in January for the payment for January, I probably paid it in December. What they've done now is for HRAs, they've said, well, that's okay for individual coverage HRAs. Don't worry about that. You know, we'll let all this happen. We had another cafeteria plan issue that was issued out in Notice 2020-29. And this allows for changes in elections mid-year. So I can change a lot of my elections in the cafeteria plan mid-years because due to the changes that we've had here with the COVID-19 emergency. For instance, you might have been deferring to a dependent care program and you were paying for your kid's child care. What's happened in the interim is the child care program is shut down. You know, there's nowhere you can send the children for child care, but that money would continue to come out of your paycheck. And in theory, you just lose it at the end of the year because that just has to be used in the current year. So what they've said is we will allow you to make changes for things like what health care plans you're choosing, allow you to drop health coverage. But if you drop health coverage, there is a special rule there that you have to show that you still have valid health care coverage. So an employee that does it can't just do that. The actual guidance is in the PDF, has all the things you can do. Now, one key takeaway from this, while you're allowed to do that, it is going to require an eventual amendment of the plans. So your cafeteria plan will have to be amended after the fact. Now, what was interesting is some of these had discovered that some companies had already been allowing people to change their elections. Technically, you can't change those elections except in very, very limited circumstances, and nothing said about a worldwide pandemic was one of those special circumstances. Nobody had kind of written that in the law. Well, understanding that a lot of plans had already done it, the guidance basically allows any plan that already did it could go ahead and just be grandfathered in. We're not going to go after you because you allowed people to make these changes earlier in the year. Dropping the FSA coverage, you know, I shouldn't say FSA, dropping the dependent care coverage was one of the big things that a lot of people allowed their employees to do because it was kind of ridiculous. There was nothing, no place to send it. Why should they still have to take the deferral? That said, of course, the law didn't really allow for a change. Now, one other change they had, if you are in fact using the grace period, remember where we said you end up with money in your medical FSA at the end of the year, and you have this unlimited time frame to use that money, you had unlimited carryover, you had a short time frame till March 15th to use it. Under the changes made in this ruling, that grace period for the year that ends, for the year basically, that would end on December 31st, 2019, or, you know, all the way through technically the end of 20, although it's irrelevant at a certain point, those grace periods are going to be extended all the way to the end of 2020, if the plan wants. So instead of having to use those funds up by March 15th, the plan can allow the employees to use those funds all the way up until the end of December. This is obviously meant to help deal with some higher cost issues that may occur if somebody gets somebody has a COVID-19 diagnosis and they need treatment. So it would help cover that. Now we also have a few here fixes for high deductible health plans. It allows them to not be interfered with these changes. That's a key issue. Now, as I noted, if you do this, you will have to amend the plan. The amendment date is going to be by December 31st of 2021. So you can operate your cafeteria plan today as if these amendments are in place, but you have to get the amendment done by the end of 21. That's kind of your big thing. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is interesting. It's an IRS FAQ. And this particular FAQ deals with some benefits that were given to colleges to give funds to various students they had. And what this plans to do is, this is the FAQ, Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund Emergency Financial Aid Grants under the CARES Act. This was posted on May the 7th. The Department of Education gave colleges funds to assist students who ran into certain COVID-19 issues. It could be any sort of assistance basically the college wanted. It could have assisted with, you know, cost for room and board. It could have assisted with cost for, you know, books, whatever, because let's say, you know, for whatever reason, they couldn't get the money back. They couldn't get over back overseas where they needed to be to maybe do a job. Whatever reason, they could be given extra money. The question became, though, because Code Section 61 says all income from all sources are taxable, is do these college students need to report this as taxable income? And what the IRS decided was, that was question one, the IRS decided that this actually is not taxable to the student. Rather, they said this is a Section 139 disaster relief payment. Now, that's interesting because this is the second time in an FAQ the IRS now has specifically stated, and this time actually said we can do the exclusion, for any payments made to somebody that relate to disaster relief under Section 139. Reasonable payments to assist with some issues they're having because of the disaster. So if you have, as an employer, been thinking about using that 139 provision, I know Tony Nitti had an article that he wrote for the Forbes online blog he writes that talked a lot about it. Some people were deciding, but thinking, I don't know if it really works. I see that one ruling he talked about where they kind of conceded that it would be, except this wouldn't qualify as a payment under that provision anyway. You know, now you've got something where the IRS has come out straight out and said, yes, this is a 139 issue. Now, they also covered one other issue just to make sure they don't get whipsawed. If the student uses those funds for something that could be taken as a deduction, like tuition and fees deduction, or maybe could increase their, you know, their HOPE credit or their, you know, their credits for their lifetime learning credit, American, yeah, all of those things, the credits that we have for going to school. The IRS said, frankly, if you use the funds for those purposes, you cannot claim an increased credit. You cannot claim a deduction for anything used for that. Yeah, we're going to recognize it that way. Finally, this week, we did get something. Hey, it's relatively normal and doesn't relate at all to COVID-19. We got the annual numbers that tell us the inflation-adjusted amounts for health savings accounts and for high-deductible health plans. This is for 2021. And what the law tells us there is our contribution limits for health savings accounts, assuming you're qualified to make them, will be $3,600 for self only and $7,200 for the family. Now, that is a combination of what an employer may put in for the employee into the HSA or what the individual puts into their own, right? So we have those combination limits. Now, in order to qualify to do anything for an HSA, the only health care coverage you can have is with a qualifying high deductible health plan. And high deductible health plans have to have certain minimum amounts that have to be their deductible or they're not an HDHP. We also updated those this year. So the minimum deductible for a health care plan to be considered a high deductible health plan for 2021 is going to be $1,400 for self only, $2,800 for family. Normally in these programs, you can't get any benefit until you clear those numbers. Now, that said, remember, we've had a number of things now specifically added that are allowed to be paid by the high deductible health plan, like telemedicine for 2 years is in there. We've had certain other rules for testing for COVID-19, et cetera, that they can cover that without us having to worry about, blowing our HDHP status. So be aware there, things are different. Make sure you get the other coverage. But the actual limits for next year, yeah, we now know them. Well, you know, I've actually been teaching real CP courses here. Now, I will admit, for now, they've almost all been teaching courses on issues related to the COVID-19 relief. And I'm going to do that again this week. So I'll have another course this week. And this one will be for the Washington Society of CPAs. On May the 27th, we're going to be doing an 8-hour all day. Now, like I said, we did some of these have been 4 hours each day. And some have been 8 hours all the way through. This will be an 8 hours all the way through. It will begin at 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time and will run to 3:30 Pacific Daylight Time on the 27th. It is a webcast, so no, you do not go to the Washington Society offices to take this course. I will be doing it from Phoenix, but it will go over all the COVID-19 tax law changes, going back to all the bills we've had, going back to IRS relief, talking about due dates, talking about forgiveness. We are going to spend a lot of time on the forgiveness calculation and what we've gotten both in the application and this week's IFR will be covered. So we'll talk about that in detail. We'll talk about other issues, talk about all the payroll tax credits. We'll talk about the other relief like the payments you're getting for the advance payment on the 2020 credit going to individuals related to this. We'll talk about the QIP, about the qualified improvement property fix that they got. We'll talk about the change in 163J interest. All of those neat things that have been in these bills from day one. We'll also briefly, most likely at the end, also review some major changes from the SECURE Act that, you know, at this point, you're kind of almost forgetting that was passed. It was and is a big thing. So if you can join us for those courses, go to the Washington Society of CPAs website and sign up for the courses. They will be coming into play here on this course on the 27th. In June, I will be doing this course one more time for Illinois CPAs. The Illinois Society has booked it in June. I'll also be doing some regular CPE, and I should be doing sessions that will be broadcast for the New Jersey Society, the Arizona Society, and be doing a set of broadcast courses for Oregon, so the Oregon Society. So if you want to check out their catalogs, remember, it is a time to start signing up for CPE. It's time to take a look. So we'll be doing that, and I probably will do a few more short COVID discussions, PPP discussions for various things. We already have one scheduled for June 1st on the Idaho Society, so we'll take a look, see if we have more of those coming up. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments, and we actually did developments this week for the week of May the 25th, 2020. You can catch our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. We also, questions and comments should be sent to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @edzollers. I also follow discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, and Washington. So, if you post something on those, I'll try to see it and see what I can do. I also follow, as is noted, the site for Reddit. So if you go to /r/taxbros, we'll have some more information there. As I say, we're expecting some additional guidance. We knew we'd get some this weekend. I don't think the two we just saw are anywhere close to the end of guidance we'll get. We're also watching these brand new bills. So it's going to be interesting for the next couple of weeks to see what happens and to see whether we get a brand new bill and we have new dates. And obviously that brings new rules into play, as well as how they interpret what we have to date. So in any event, stay tuned, come back to us, and join us again next week as we'll again discuss current federal tax developments.